advertising is often designed to feed a lack of contentedness. We're shown beautiful people enjoying things we don't own, implying that we won't be happy until we have what they have. Well, today on Truth for Life, we'll hear another message from our Encore 2015 series. Alistair Begg describes God's remedy for the poison of envy.
I came here in October, in August the 3rd, 1983. I started trying to get intelligent, read the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal, Wednesday, October 12th, 1983. Here it is. Headline, inside full-page advertisement in the Wall Street is headed, "Demoralize Thy Neighbor." Okay? Now, this is an Aston Martin for those of you who are car aficionados. It's one thing to trundle by in a Bentley, Jaguar, Mercedes, or the like. Everyone in your neighborhood has one of those. It's quite another thing to come in for a landing in your Lagonda. The Lagonda is an Aston Martin, blah, 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 blah. And if you get an Aston Martin, then all the poor clowns in your neighborhood that only drive Jaguar, Mercedes, and BMW, you're going to make them go to bed feeling really bad. So why don't you buy a Lagonda? Now, doesn't that appeal to everything that's good in us? Doesn't it? You're sensible people. Think this stuff out. Is the Bible relevant to our day? Of course it is. It's powerfully applicable to our day. It gets to the very heart of the issues. Now, if the evidence of coveting is plain for all to see, what about the effect of coveting? What effect does coveting have? Let me say four things that coveting will do. Simple things, obvious perhaps, but let me just underpin them. Number one, coveting spoils relationships and lies behind many of our disagreements. You take a couple of youngsters who tranked together through school. They were the best of friends. They spent overnights. They did homework together. They were neck and neck all the way through. They graduated well. They went on to college well. They were still neck and neck. But after college, one of them went orbital in terms of financial success, and the other one went on a slower track. The slower track fellow can't stand the success of this guy, and so when he calls, he's no longer as interested. Their friendship is no longer cemented. Their care for one another is no longer what it was. Because this guy's got a covetous heart, and he can't stand the success of another. That happens between brothers and sisters in a family. It happens in churches. It happens between pastors. Secondly, covetousness breaks the summary commandment of Jesus, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." It's impossible to really love somebody and to be coveting their stuff when we should say, "My, that is a very pretty color on you." Our covetous hearts say nothing, and we get in our car saying, "I don't know why she got that." You can't have a covetous heart. I can't have a covetous heart and really love you. Thirdly, a covetous heart makes me essentially selfish, makes me always ask what's best for me. How will I do in this? How am I going to come out of this? What will happen to me in this deal? And fourthly, a covetous heart, and perhaps worse of all, makes us think that life is all about material things. That the abundance of life is really what we've got. That he who dies with the most toys wins. That we buy the whole package. Nelson Rockefeller, interviewed by a newspaper reporter on one occasion, was asked, "How much money does it take to be happy?" And Rockefeller replied, "Just a little bit more." Think about it. Think about it when you're a child. Your father says you can have this much of an allowance. You're really thrilled. You're pleased. After all, you had nothing before he said it. Then he said it, then he gave you it. You're thrilled. Till you walk outside and you say to your friend, "Hey, my dad gave me an allowance. Gave me a dollar." Your friend says, "My dad gave me two." Now you're going to find out what kind of covetous heart you've got. You can't be content with a dollar in your pocket for worrying about the fact that the guy next to you has got $2 in his. That's what happens in churches. It's what happens in companies. It's what what happens in families. Well, then the question is obvious. If the problem is as endemic as that, if it is as deep-rooted as that, if it is as crucial as that, how in the world are we going to root it out? What are we going to do? Well, the answer is that we need to bring an eternal perspective to bear upon the effects of time. And in order to do that, I want you to turn with me to a story that is recorded for us in Luke chapter 12, and we'll make this our concluding illustration. Luke chapter 12 and verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher," this is to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." All attorneys tell me they've never seen as many squabbles in their life as when they have to do with wills and the reading of wills. You know, perfect friends become total enemies forever after they come in and say, the last will and testament of Reginald Bozanquet as follows, and the person who thinks they're going to make a bundle gets nothing. It goes to the Jogger Humane Society to spay cats or something. And people get really ticked off over that stuff, I believe, and justifiably so, especially as it relates to cats, but that's another question altogether. The fact of the matter is there was a problem between these characters. Presumably one had it all and didn't want to give it up, and one didn't have it and wanted to get it. So there you've got the perfect recipe for it. The guy's got it and won't give it up. A guy hasn't got it and must get it. That's it, right there. And it's right here. So he says, "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus says, "Hey, look, I'm not in the business of dividing inheritances up. That's not why I came. There are people who can take care of that." He said, "But since you're so concerned about stuff, as you clearly are, and since you're so concerned about having an inheritance, let me tell you a story about a guy who was so sure that he had a good inheritance." And then he goes on to bring this eternal perspective to bear upon the circumstances of possessions. Let me try and summarize it for us, if I may. First of all, he says to the individual, watch out, verse 15, or be alert. Don't just go with the flow. Don't just accept when people say everybody wants to be number one. Be alert. Let your antenna go up for that and say, hey, wait a minute. If everybody wants to be number one and can be number one, we got a problem with everybody else who's 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And since I've spent most of my life being a good 7 or an 8 or a 9 or a 10, there's not much chance of me being number one. Be alert, he says. Think these things out. Secondly, beware. Be on your guard, he says, against all kinds of greed. The comprehensive nature of greed is addressed here by Jesus. He says, make sure that you appoint sentries at the doors of your life, at the avenues of your existence, that guard against the inroads of greed. You know, he says, the things that create that response within you. Make sure that you set it up in such a way that you are not only alert to its advances, but you are ready for the advances. And thirdly, be clear, he says. Be clear about this. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Now I ask you, loved ones, is that a revolutionary statement or what? Because today in our culture, prestige and power and recognition and influence are almost exclusively tied to possessions. Think it out. In an earlier generation, perhaps, although we didn't live there and we can't say with authority, in an earlier generation, it would appear at least that certain things were valued above possessions. For example, the school teacher with a caring heart that instructed Anne of Green Gables, okay? The doctor who was prepared in all days and times and conditions to go out for the delivery of the baby and everything else. The pastor who was prepared to bring spiritual comfort and care to the dying and to the bereaved and to the wayward and to the lost. Those things may have been valued in earlier generations, but by and large in our contemporary culture, the substance of a man's existence and his prestige is directly related to external, superficial, non-lasting stuff. Now, loved ones, if we don't believe that, we got to ask ourselves the question why it is we're spending so much time to get that stuff. And why we attach such significance to the stuff when we get it. It is because we have bought into the mindset of our generation. Now, all of us are tainted with it. None of us, whether we've got a lot or a wee drop, can say we're not into it. It's not a problem of the haves. It's a problem of the have-nots as well as the haves. Indeed, many of us who have not have maybe got a more covetous heart than many of the people who have. And one of the indications of our covetous heart is that we like to badmouth the people who have just because we haven't. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. The word there for life is the word zoe, which means the essence of a man's life. There is another word in Greek for life, which is bios, from which we get biology, which is the way of life. Jesus doesn't say that the way of a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. He says the essence of a man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of his possessions. See, my good friend in Scotland, who died on Thursday from cancer, had a lot of possessions. He had a Rolls Royce. He had the largest Ford dealership in Scotland. He had power. He had influence. But he's also the guy who, when he took the Ford dealership, only had £2,000 to his name that his dad had left him. When the Ford dealer came to him and said, "Mr. Cordner, you're going to open a garage up here in Aberdeen?" "Yes, I am." So he said, "Well, let me show you the prospectus of how you do it. This is how Ford wants the places opened up." Said, "This is the opening times." Stephen looked at the opening times. He said, "I got a problem with this." He says, "I'm not going to open on a Sunday." The guy said, "What do you mean you're not going to open on a Sunday?" He said, "Well, I'm not going to open on a Sunday." He said, "I go to church on Sundays. I worship the Lord on Sunday, and I believe that Sunday is the Lord's day." The guy says, "You can't have a Ford franchise if you don't open on Sunday." The guy says, "Well, then I don't have a Ford franchise." "But I'll tell you what," he said, "you trust me with a Ford franchise, and I'll sell more cars for you in Scotland in 6 days than anyone else will sell in 7. The guy says, "Well, it's against the rules. It's against the protocol. But we'll do it." And I want to tell you something. The people who will attend that funeral service for Stephen Cordner will not be there because he had a Rolls Royce. Most people don't even know he's got it. They will not be there because of the abundance of his possessions. They will be there because that clarity of his Christian testimony so pervaded everything about that man's life that it was impossible to know him without knowing that a man's life does not consist in the abundance of what he possesses. Some of us, whether with much or with little, whether teenagers or kids, have never crossed that bridge. We know it theoretically, we do not believe it experientially. And we live crippled by a covetous heart. Because we'll never, ever have enough according to our perspective. Once that becomes a drug, the heroin addict cannot shoot up enough, nor can the materialist. You talk to anyone who's in retailing around the malls of the city, and they will tell you that there are people who are not only on the lists who get the little card that says, "Come for our sale," but they're on the special list, the high priority list, which says the minute a new shipment of anything arrives, call me. Because I cannot stand the possibility that my neighbor comes down the street with it first. We're talking about intravenous materialism at that point. We're talking about shooting up big time. And Jesus says it's absolutely bogus. And so he illustrates it. He says the guy decided that he would keep for himself what he might have given away to others. He stored up for a future that never came. He says to himself in verse 19, I'll say to myself, you got plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. You got plenty of time. He had plenty of stuff and no time. He was foolish enough to presume that he would have forever to enjoy what he'd made, and he was wrong. I got to preach this to some of you men as well. And I know you misunderstand me, but I'm going to preach it to you anyway. I have buried more men than I can tell you who refused to stop working. It was not because they didn't have enough money. It was because they were consumed with their annuities and their investments. The one thing they were not going to do was touch principal. And if I can just work a little bit longer, I get it a little fatter, that will mean we will live off the interest always, and the nest egg will be big. And the wife, you say, honey, why don't we take a day off? I mean, why don't we go for a little trip? Why don't we sail on a boat? Why don't we take a train? Why don't we, no, wait a minute. Just let me go for another wee while, and when I finish, you're going to see, you'll never have been on a vacation like we're going on. We'll just go round and round and round the globe as many times as you want. And we'll never have to touch the principle. That's what I love. We'll never touch the principle. He never touched squat of it because he's dead. And I sit with his wife. She's got fat wads of money and she's lonely and she's empty. And she was always going to have the vacations that never ever came. Because he stored for a future that he couldn't bank on. Now, what's the lesson from that? That you don't plan for the future? No, that would be silly. The lesson is carpe diem. Seize the day. You want to take your wife a walk? Take her a walk this afternoon, because if you plan it for next Thursday, you may not be here. You want to buy your children an ice cream? Buy it now. You want to snuggle them in their beds? Snuggle them tonight. Don't snuggle them when you become smart enough to take 4 days off a week. You may never live long enough. Snuggle them tonight because it's the only night you've got. Love your wife today. It's the only day you have. Use your resources this afternoon because it's the only time that you may use them and know the benefit of generosity. You'll never have the fun of giving stuff away when you're dead. Who cares that your attorney gets the chance to dish it out to everybody? You're not going to have a lot of fun in that. Well, our time is gone. The lesson is clear. A covetous heart can only be driven out by the expulsive power of a new affection. The expulsive power of a new affection. The psalmist's statement is as challenging as any I can ever read. When he says, whom have I in heaven but you? That's good. We can all say that. I mean, whom have we in heaven but God? The answer is no one but God. And then he says, and earth has nothing I desire besides you. Psalm 73, verse 25. I'm not there yet. I don't know if you are, but I'm not. But I want to be. I want to find out what that means. I know for sure it doesn't mean stripping yourself naked and lying in a cave somewhere. I know that's not it. Jesus never taught that. I know it's not about going in a monastery. I know it's not about communism. I know it's about the fact that some of us are going to be given more than others, and whatever we're given, we've got to make sure that we use it to the glory of God, and we don't covet what other people have, and we don't look down our long noses on others because they never were blessed in the same way as we. But it's a hard one. And I wonder, when's the last time you ever heard a sermon on the sin of coveting? I bet you can't remember one. Because nobody wants to preach on coveting. Because there's a whole lot of coveting going on. And nobody can avoid these bullets. I know I can't. Don't try.
You're listening to Truth for Life with Alistair Begg. It's one of the most frequently requested sermons during the last 12 months. Today's message is featured in our Encore 2015 series. And if you'd like to hear this entire sermon, it's called The Other Man's Grass, and you can download the audio file for free at truthforlife.org. You may be listening to Alistair on the radio. Perhaps you're hearing today's program on your smartphone or your tablet. Maybe you're listening online through Facebook. There is a small team here at Truth for Life that makes all of this technology available. But you should know there's a larger family of friends who make it all possible. I'm talking about our Truth Partners. A Truth Partner is someone who commits to pray for this ministry regularly and to give a donation each month. And in doing so, these folks help carry the burden of the expense associated with this program. They make it possible to distribute Alistair's teaching to anyone who wants to learn more about the Bible at no cost. Whether you listen to Truth for Life on the radio, through one of our free mobile apps, or by downloading messages at no cost from our website, we want to invite you to become a part of the enabling group of listeners today. Become a Truth Partner. Call us at 888-588-7884 or sign up online at truthforlife.org/truthpartner. When you give your first gift today as a Truth Partner, we will say thank you by providing a devotional book written by Eric Alexander. Eric is one of Alistair's longtime friends and a mentor in ministry. His book is called Our Great God and Savior. Call 888-588-7884 or go online to truthforlife.org. To give a donation today and to make your request for the book in writing, our address in the U.S. is Truth for Life, Box 39-8000, Cleveland, Ohio, 44139. If you're listening in Canada, include your gift and request the book when you write to Post Office Box 19008, Delta, B.C., V4L2P8. Now here's a look ahead to Thursday's program as Alistair Begg presents Good News for Lawbreakers.
What are we then to make of this message as it has come so clearly to us? The message has not been, if only everyone would get on with seeking to embrace the Ten Commandments, then we'd all be a lot better off. If that has appeared to be the message, then I have failed you. You certainly have misunderstood. I must have miscommunicated. If the reaction has been to say, well, I think what I've been learning is that I need to try a lot harder if I'm going to make a go of this Christian life business, then again, something has gone sadly wrong. However, if the studies have brought us to verse 20 of chapter 3 of Romans, then the Spirit of God has done His work. For through the law, says Paul, we become conscious of our sin. I'd like this morning to address this, to wrap up, as it were, this series under three headings, the first of which is the condition to be faced. We've been discovering, and we need to reaffirm it today, that the law of God was never given to save us. Rather, what we've discovered is that the law of God has been given to pinpoint sin, to define it, to bring it out of its hiding place, as it were, and to show us the immensity of our problem. To show some of us who never believed that we had a problem, that in actual fact, we do. To show us that the wonderful good news can only be understood against the background of the bad news. To understand that the provision which God has made is only relevant in the heart and life of the individual who understands the awfulness of the condition that we face.
We'll be looking at Romans chapter 3 on tomorrow's program. I'm Bob Lapine for Alistair Begg, inviting you to join us again Thursday as the Encore 2015 series continues on Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.